What's up, everybody? This is A7X Fan Ben, and welcome to Pirate CSG podcast number 60. This is part two of the epic interview with game designer Mike Mulvihill, and you can find tabs and resources in the description to some of the stuff that I was looking at during the podcast. Feel free to use the affiliate link in the description to buy stuff from eBay that'll help support my content. Thanks for listening, and without further ado, here we go. Do you remember when the sets were designed compared to when they were released? So such as like design versus on store shelves. I saw like a 2 to 4 month estimate in a video, but I don't know if it differed for Pirates.
Oh no. It was longer than 2 to 4 months. Oh my
Okay.
God.
Like I know Pirates of the Spanish Main may have originated in 2003 and then it was released in July 2004, but that may have been longer because it was the first set and like the concept. I don't know what the average was for like Crimson Coast and Beyond, if it was like 6 months.
I wish I could tell you. I will tell you this. I never was not working on a Pirates game at some
Nice.
point. So I like there was no downtime. It was right, everything was different back then, and when I mean everything, I mean literally everything. So you got to remember too that people go, "Oh, it was on the shelf, so you worked on it this long." And I'm like, "No, not really. I worked on it way less than that." Because you got to figure that by the time it got on shelves anywhere, it had been sitting on the ocean for 8 weeks. It's created and and then it takes a month, anywhere from, this is, let's just assume a month just to manufacture it, before it goes on a ship to this thing. We have an approval step at that manufacturing level. We have two technically. We have like they do like their first printing of everything. So we would get these sheets on paper of all the cards, and then we would do any kind of edits or changes or fixes to anything that we saw. And then we would get an overnighted shipment of things where we could do our audit to make sure that the sort was correct. And that would happen before it got shipped out. So let's just say it's 4 weeks on or 8 weeks on the water. And then there's probably 1 or 2 weeks in the US as it goes from the port to the warehouse to the store.
Yeah,
So
customs.
let's assume another month in there just to make it the math round. So that's 3 months of it not doing anything, plus a month of manufacturing. So that's 4 months right there. So now, while that, let's just say that that's Revolutions, right? I'm already working on Barbary Coast the minute I'm done with Revolutions. So for those 4 months, I'm working on Barbary Coast, but I'm not turning it over 4 months later. It is probably, God, I don't know. I'm gonna say like, I'm gonna let us say at a maximum it was a year.
Okay.
From me pitching the idea to it being on a shelf. But the bottom line is like Barbary Coast, South China Seas, I think I pitched as a combo of things because I said like we wanted to make the world of. So that may have gone at the same time, like from a pitching standpoint. I didn't work on South China Sea until I was done with Barbary Coast, but from a I didn't have to go through the multiple days or weeks of getting people to give me feedback on it. I had already that feedback. But I would say 1 year is probably a good number from like literally total concept. Now, I'm also doing research on the next set while I'm doing the set I'm on and all that kind of stuff. Because, like I said, I have to pitch it to people. So there's a massive amounts of overlap in there. So that's why I say a year. It's probably not a year of direct work, but a year of when that concept starts or when I need to start doing research, maybe a little bit more. Once, it's greenlit and the team is all going on it, then everything works in weird stages. This is totally different than doing the miniatures games. You had a whole different cadence. This one, I would, like I said, right away, I'd have to get the Ethan. We'd have to see how to make the new ship. We would, die cut it ourselves in the office to see if it would work. Then we would send the die cut off. Then we'd send it off to China for them to do a white model. I have a white model of one of the ships around the here someplace. One of the original ones. I don't know what it is. If I do have it, I'll take a photo and send it to you. But nice. Every once in a while, all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, look, it's a white model of a junk, I think. Nice. But it's, you know, that kind of stuff we would do. And just to make sure we you know, it could work. You know, and then the art team is doing their stuff. I would almost always make, you know, like at that point, then I'd be writing like the characters probably before the ships, because that's longer artwork. The ships were all done in house, you know, but the paintings of the characters were done by a freelancer. So you have to schedule that person. Yep. And so then you got to give them all the, you know, I got to give them all the descriptions of those guys. So it's this kind of weird cadence thing of like, you know, do this thing that I'm not actually needing to be, you know, needing to work on first, but I have to do it first because other people, that's the other people's first thing they have to work on. So it kind of crosses over. So yeah, let's give it a year from initial concepting to shelf, and then realize that that's broken up into chunks of like fire and not fire, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, I'm reading this board game publisher book right now that another member from the Pirates community recommended. And yeah, it's kind of staggering to see like all the steps involved and just the sheer amount of like hands in the pot, if you will, and like the different lag time that each step can create, and how that can incur additional costs and prototyping and things like that. So
yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I mean, I worked at WizKids and we were a great team. And then I went out of board games and now I'm at Ravensburger and it is the same kind of team, except with way higher quality production in the testing process and prototyping, because it's we have a guy who does it and he's incredible. And 3D modeling occurred.
Some of the technology.
I mean, literally, I'm telling you, we would draw it up. We would fake make it. We would, you know, we're cutting basically styrene, white pieces of styrene to see if we could get things to work correctly with X-Acto knives. And then we would send it off to China and we'd have to wait a month, 3 weeks, whatever, before we got one sample or three samples back with their making suggestions, because they have to make it. So they have to make sure that it fits all the thing. We had to have special distances between all the pieces of plastic because of any kind of offset in the stamping or the print run.
Yeah, the bleed.
And so it was like crazy. So we would do all that and then we'd get one in and we'd all look at it and go, I think this works. Yeah, this works. You know, and if it doesn't work, we start the process all over again. Meanwhile, you know, some guy with a 3D printer is like, here it is. It's like an hour later. You're like, oh God, what the hell?
Yeah. So it's gotten crazy the past 20 years.
When I was going to working uphill both directions. So
yeah, it's amazing how much it's developed the past 20 plus years. So awesome. So what thoughts or concept went behind the development of individual ships and crew?
That one.
I know some were historical, but a lot of them.
Yeah. So what ended up happening was there's a couple of things. First off, man, there are some great pirate reference books, but actually the most helpful book, and I was looking for it before we started talking and I cannot find it. I don't own it because it's like in the British Naval Museum or something like that. It was a book written by it's not a book. It's not like something you read. It's like a reference. Some British admiral during the height of the letters of marque / age of sail period wrote a book or kept a log. And in this log was every British ship, their captain of the ship at that time that he knew of. And like you would see like six captains sometimes of the same ship, because either the guy died or he got scurvy or pirates took it over and then somebody else took it back from them. But basically it's like a running log of every ship during that period of time. And you would get some great thing. Like you'd be looking through it and all of a sudden it'll be like shipwrecked or crew mutinied, you know, and stuff like that. You're like, what? Because these guys would all come back home. That was the funniest thing. Pirates were so dumb. You know, they would all come back. They would steal a ship. They would rob from a couple other ships and then it'd sell back into London. Like, hey, who's going to be upset with us now? You know, it's like, what are you idiots? That's right. You were all like literally the lowest common denominator people doing the lowest common denominator job and all just trying to survive.
Yeah.
But what I found the coolest thing about that book was that it gave me, like, one, it gave me a bazillion names. That's really the hardest thing, is to try to make names of ships that fit the thing. Secondly, so it's like I said, a lot of times the starting was the concept, Barbary Coast. I had to have a list of, like, protagonists, if you will, of why this would be good on both sides, on all the sides of the factions. So because it's the Mediterranean, you got to have Redbeard in there. You got to have... you know, the British commanders, Wellington, or probably not Wellington. That's probably the wrong period of time. And I don't even know if he's in our game, but you know, I would find these references to these ship battles and who was in them. And those were where I would get my main protagonists from. So, because again, I had to get those to art before I get them ship stuff. They could start making and coloring ships at any time because they didn't need me to, tell them, oh, this ship needs to be blue. That was 100% art. What a ship looks like, 100% on the art team. Yep. You know, they didn't need me to, once they had, you know, once I, you know, I would come up and I need to give them a portrait. So I need to write some fictional backstory. Then almost everybody who I felt was a captain should have a link ship to them. And so now all of a sudden I got ships that I need to have. Okay, now what is this guy? Oh, he was a raider. So he doesn't get the big giant four-masted thing. He's going to get a bunch of faster ships, maybe a three, maybe a bunch of really fast twos, you know, something like that. And so then I'd start to basically, almost like the guys who do the thing where they have like the cork board where they're, you know, putting the clues and they're like, okay, this guy was here and now I got the line here. It was almost kind of be built that way from a structure standpoint of saying, okay, I got crew, I got their ships. What's our new ability? Let's make sure it's in enough places. What's a cool old ability that may counter the new ability so that this set doesn't, you know, become the only set anybody ever plays? Are there older sets? Are there characters we can bring over? Like, you know, because it was in the Mediterranean, we can do a lot of stuff with the Spanish crews and captains. Maybe some French guys were captured since those were all, you know, that was the whole Gold Coast area. And, you know, now we also have some, you know, African prince ships, you know, besides the Mediterranean. So we can have a different color and look to our crew. And all of a sudden you're starting to play kind of with that tableau. And also then, you know, as you're starting to design that tableau of the characters and their abilities and their fiction, you're starting to go, okay, what ships, what's cool in, you know, what's cool in stuff we already have? Because we made cool stuff. So how do we interpret that cool stuff here? What abilities do we use? And so it becomes kind of like making a puzzle. There's a scene. Everybody who's ever taken any class from me in game design, because I used to teach, well, no, this is a scene that I bring up all the time. There's the movie Apollo 13, a very famous movie. Hopefully everybody's seen it. But if you go look up the engineering scene online on YouTube, they come up, they discover what the problem is, and they tell the head engineer guy that we have this part, and it's got a circle. It's like a circle vacuum tube. And it needs to fit into this, and it's like a square kind of a square filter thing. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "You've got to be kidding me!" And they're like, "No, that if we don't fix this, they're dead." And so the next scene is the guy. They bring all the engineers into the room, and the now the head working engineer, not the head of the program control center.
Yeah.
He's in the front with the two other guys. They're all in their white shirts with their thin black ties. And he's like, okay, everybody, this is what we now know. We now know that we have this piece and we have this piece. They now need to connect together. And here's what you get. And then they throw on the table all the parts of the ship that are now no longer being used for anything. And then the engineers start grabbing stuff and that's game design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because so I'm looking at the fact that, okay, I have some new things. I have a new ability that I thought of because of the Barbary Coast Raiders more so than that. So I now have a new ability maybe. Maybe there's some new crew guys that do some cool stuff that lead to that kind of feel. I have this new ship type. Okay, Now I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 worth of sets of ships. And this is where like playtesting was really important as the game went on, because I'll go, man, this ship fits right here. And then somebody will go, dude, this is the same. And not only is it the same ship, but it's the same faction. You just basically recreated the, you know, HMS, you know, Bounty in Barbary Coast and called it the HMS, you know, Scallywag. And I'm like, crap. Okay. So now I gotta adjust something. What do I adjust? You know, but that it's not like you sit down and start at the first ship 001 and go all the way through to ship, you know, whatever it is, and then crew, you know, 001 and go all the way through the crew. No, you actually, you bounce around.
Yep.
You go, okay, I've created this character. He's got to have a link ship. He's got a link ship. Well, what other ships can fit that? I need it to be the new ship type, blah, blah, blah. Now I need to give it an ability. What's his background? What's his story? Okay, this is a cool background. This is a cool ability. They work together. This is awesome. Now let's do another. Now, you know, who else am I needing to do? I'm very proud of the fact that I never sent art back. So if they gave me a portrait of somebody, I didn't go, oh, that's not what I do. I'll change the game mechanics to match the portrait or whatever. But it's not like I see final art. I see the sketches as well. I'll see, you know, all the drawings or all the art references. When Shane's really good at this, he would just go, here are all the art references of the characters that you listed here. And I'll be like, that's awesome. I don't see anything. This is great. And then sometimes that also gives me clues and going, oh, wait, maybe I should do this and move this guy to this ship and do this other thing with this. You know, it really, it's much more of an art than a science, at least for me in creating things. So there's no one mold where I go, oh, I make this ship first in every set and this character second in every ship. It's really how the sets morph and work. I mean, and then like when you have something like Davy Jones, you have a whole different, you know, there's a whole different party involved with that. I know what all the things are. We've all seen the stories, you know, how do I make these ships do these things? Well, we know these handful of ships, the 5 or 6 that are actually mentioned, you know, they are incredibly important. One, they say this is the fastest ship in the world, so I can't make it an S, you know, I have to make it an L plus an S, and I maybe even have to give it a, you know, if you move L and S, you get to move an extra S, you know, as an ability, you know, so you have to start to do that kind of stuff again, you know, and then, you know, send it out to playtesters and hope for the best a lot of times. And a lot of times you get like, this is really cool. Or you get like, you do know you duplicated the ship twice in the same set. And I'm like, ah, damn, you know? So, but that I don't think I answered your question because I don't think that's how I would answer it. So,
I mean, no, you totally did. I mean, start with some of it was like the historical list, and then other stuff is you start with the theme of the set and then you just go from there, and it evolves as you see the art and get feedback from playtesters. So it all makes total sense. So,
okay, awesome. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've designed a few thousand like custom pieces and whatnot. And it definitely sounds familiar to like kind of like a puzzle map where you got kind of a set theme that like slowly evolves over time. And then you figure out which factions you want to add and which might be more powerful than others in that set for different reasons and things like that.
There's one thing we never got to do, which I really, really kind of wanted to do, and you can see it evolve a little bit, I think. And that was, I really wanted to do, for lack of a better term, kind of like team ups or mixed teams. And you could see every once in a while there'll be like a crew member that could work on a different ship, different faction. But I really wanted to figure out a way to do it. You just didn't really have the constant design space. I would have loved to like throw a couple of like, let's say, jade pirates into the, you know, Frozen North, you know, with a junk ship in there, something like that. That would have just been a different kind of feel, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but we never had the design space. I think one of your questions that you may ask at some point was like the 30 point to 40 point thing. And that's kind of where that ended up happening. It started at 30 points because we figured that was more than enough ships for everybody to play this quick. Again, using Jordan's mindset of playable right out of the pack, very fast. We want this to be played by kids. Jordan's kids were in like school at the time, so he wanted a game that they could play sitting at their lunch table and during lunch hour, so it needed to be like less than 30 minutes. So you make design decisions based on that. You know, yep. If that's what the boss wants and that's what the game demands, then it's a 30-point thing. You know, two to three ships, maybe maximum four ships if you can get it to work, but in most cases, two to three with some crew. And then by the time we put out X number of sets, we're like, that is now not what the fans want. You know, if you sit down and you play, when we played our 40-point set, other than the fact that a bunch of people didn't know how to play and it was a 5-player game, and that may have been a little longer than what we wanted to, but we were chatting and doing a bunch of meet and greets and all that kind of stuff. But you don't want it to be, the mindset at the time was we still wanted it to be a fast, still wanted it to be playable, but adding 10 more points didn't really harm the dynamic.
Yeah.
What it really did was allowed for two to three more ships and more crew. And so that was, I mean, when we played, I think we all had three ships. Somebody had two because they had a giant ship. Or maybe they had three ships as well, and they just lost it very early. But, I mean, it was basically a three ship with a bunch of crew game. And that's exactly what you kind of want, with the ability to do what you did in a later game, which is play a giant game, you know. And that's fine. That's what you want, because you want people to go, you know, at a minimum, we should play this game. You could still play a 30-point game. It's going to be really fast, and it's going to be the same ships. And that was the other problem that we were starting to see early on, was in order to play a 30-point game, everybody played the same kind of ships because it was just easy to do the math.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, we want variety. You know, we have 12 sets out. Let's have a little variety in the armies.
Exactly.
You know, it was literally, you know, one faction playing those one, you know, with the same handful of ships. That's not very fun, not very interesting. So that's why we went up to 40 points, you know. And what I would have loved to have done later on was to do things at other point breaks to change up a little bit of the mechanics, to say, like, what if you were playing a 100-point game? What would it really mean, you know? But it really, in the long run, the game is tuned enough that it really just means it's time. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Still fun. Still works. So, yep. And that's always the danger, is like when it doesn't work, when it starts to do that kind of stuff. But it was tight. That's the benefit, to be honest with you, of doing the point-based system, mm-hmm. is that you maintain a balance. We learned this lesson with HeroClix, if you can maintain the balance, you never need to ban ships. You never need to take things out. You never need to say, you know, you can't use this in this game because it's broken. By maintaining that point, that adherence to that point thing, and not putting out things that don't adhere to it, you maintain.
Sorry, what was that?
The problem is at some point. So remember earlier on, I talked about like the eyeball process of creating, like, you know, just playing things and seeing where they fit in the system.
And so
you end up with, you may end up with broken cards or broken pieces or broken things because there's too many combos for you to see everything. You can only see some of them. And so that's the reason why a lot of card games have like banned, you know, cards, or you can't use these in this type of tournament because they don't fit the mode of the tournament. It's like two different sets. It's like basically what I said early on about the Dutch system or the Dutch ships. At some point the House of Ships, I guess, in this case, House of Styrene, would have collapsed because they were not honed to the rest of the set.
Yeah, you start to lose compatibility. Yep.
Right. And so when you have the point value, you do that, except for the fact that it really is dependent on how tight that point value is. So for instance, like HeroClix, we loosened it up a little bit, and there are ways to really make insanely powerful broken characters using the HeroClix system. So we kind of all had to have like an internal gentleman's agreement. Don't break the system by doing this thing. and you know, I don't know. I don't collect HeroClix. I don't know any HeroClix anymore. I don't know anything about it, but it sounds like they've gone with because I see every once in a while, I'm still on some stuff. Oh, this character's been banned from this tournament. That just tells me either they broke the system on purpose or the system wasn't meant to last that long. That's why I would be real curious to see how far this system fell for the pocket model or for Pirates pocket models, because I don't know how well we did the system. You know, we only put out those sets of cards and they all seem pretty balanced as is. I was trying to look for that one that I said I would never use that ability again in the cards, but I hadn't seen that. So
interesting. Yeah, we can tell more about
that.
But
that's my take. But, you know, I make games now that don't use point systems. So it's really just like an adherence to a certain kind of economy of things. So
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, we can definitely talk more about some of the balance as the sets went on later. Getting back to your point about the teams, I think you'll be happy to hear that players have gone a little crazy in a good way with like doing that. And what I mean is like the crew that can use their abilities on any ship. And even like what I've done is like historical alliances. Like I do the French and Americans because they teamed up in the Revolutionary War, things like that. So there's a lot of team elements that still exists in the game, especially because a lot of the best fleets are multinationality. Like a lot of people do like to play faction pure just for theming, but a lot of the most competitive fleets or some of the most fun combos are when you combine like French and pirate and English stuff all in one fleet. And actually last year I played a couple of co-op games where you actually play like a 2v2 game where you have separate home islands, but then your combined score goes against the combined score of the other two players. Then you have to like coordinate like who's going to which island and team up in like new ways that you've never thought of before. So even though it may have not have made it into the mechanics or the rules, people have definitely done a lot of team type stuff with the game. So
yeah, I mean, that's really cool. I mean, I just am so agog that people have maintained both playing it, the spirit of playing it, and then just like are taking it in those ways, because you just never know. Like I said early on, you never know when a game's going to be successful. People are going to latch onto it. You know, all you can really do is make it be real at the time it comes out, and hopefully that reality, you know, moves forward. There, you know, and you know, from my standpoint, it's to make sure that there was an infrastructure that supports it, because otherwise it wouldn't last this long. So the find out it not only supports it, but it allows you guys to do new and interesting stuff is like kind of like it's making me smile. You can't see it, but I'm smiling.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, the game has a lot of longevity and the community is still pretty active. So super fun to be a part of. Do you remember any particularly memorable game design concept meetings, such as like a divisive mechanic or faction or like a weird idea that led to more success?
I told you the ones that I remember the most were a lot of the early decisions, like, you know, the D6 one that was pretty scarring. Not the one with Mike, the one with Jordan where the tie doesn't count. That was a pretty rough one. No, later on it became more of a again, I'm a social designer, so it's not like I come down from on high and say we're doing this and then people get all grumpy or push back. I'm almost always open and asking for input. I think the biggest thrills were when Ethan and I would sit down and figure out how to make a new ship. I don't remember being upset or going, I'm gonna make sure this gets put in here, you know, hell or high water or anything like that. I mean, I think that there was always like stuff I always wanted to do, and I got to. I mean, so I don't remember there being any like negative disconnects. I know that we always wanted more than we could get in. That was always a problem. I think like my big pushback is, or me personally, this is a personal thing, not a big picture thing, and it's nothing against any of the people that I'm going to say out loud. But like when we were talking with Tiffany, for instance, who was the brand manager, and she would be working with the marketing team, and they would want a marketing set of X. Those were always discomforting me because, one, I'm trying to finish a game. I marketing is not in my, add this to the game. And now it is. Now I know how it all works and it all pulls together. But at the beginning, it was like, get out of my space. I'm trying to make this thing. Now you want, this ship. Well, it's not, you can't have one ship. We can't print that. We have to print it in blocks of something. So you need all the ships around it as well. And giving people one ship is irrelevant because you need a minimum of two ships to play the game and more if you want to play with more than one person. So there'd be like these discussions where I felt like I've said this 60, 70, 80, 100, 1,000 times. But in reality, that's the way marketing does the thing I was talking about, where I just come up with an idea and then I show it to everybody. They're just coming up with an idea and they're expecting feedback back. They were never any like, I'm not doing that or you don't want to do that. It was weird stuff like the discovery when doing South China Sea that the largest ship, sailing ship on record was the big giant junk, that super giant one. And so they're like, we want a single ship. And I'm like, what? That's interesting. I got this idea that I was reading about when I was doing my research of this super giant thing. You know, what's your budget? Because at this point now we have to make a whole separate mold, and all this kind of stuff, and we have to do something. And it was, it's so as that kind of stuff evolved that was outside of the game. That's where it became, I don't want to say problematic. That's not true. It just became, there would be pushback by me because I was like, I got to get the set done. You're not marketing anything unless I do the actual set. But those were few and far between. And it was me and Tiffany, as you can see, we get along and give each other shit all the time. So, and she's a really good friend and I love her dearly. And so it was never anything about, her or me. It was like time. It was almost always timing. Dude, don't come to me when I'm on a deadline and ask me to do another thing. So that was usually the case, but nothing from a mechanic standpoint. Like I can't believe we got in the ships we did, and I can't, and that was Ethan doing yeoman's work on trying to figure out how to get that placed in the thing. It was, getting, if somebody wrote something that I was like, ooh, that's not the direction I want to go in, I don't just like ignore them and rewrite it myself. I'd send it back and go, hey, here's the thing. Let's talk about this. I mean, we're all in the same office. I'm like, hey, I like all this, but I don't like this character. This is my dream of this guy. He's like, oh, well, I thought he was this guy and I wanted to do this guy. And I'm like, no, that's not how we wanted to do it. So, it's not how I want to do it. Maybe we come to an understanding. Maybe I go, oh, wow, your way is cooler than mine. It's not I hope that people who work with me don't go, Mike's such a jerk. He's so hard to work with. I hope they say, wow, he's really cool to work with. And he gave me chances to do stuff that I would never have thought of. But if there was any conflicts, it would have been on stuff like that. Anytime I'm not doing it, I guess, you always run into that creative difference. So.
Yep. Yeah. Makes sense. So getting into one of the other questions from the community, Chris was wondering what computer programs were used to aid in the design of the game pieces.
I used Excel almost exclusively. And in presentations back then, PowerPoint was probably not in our wheelhouse. So it was probably something just like a Word spec document that I would do. The art team, I don't know what they used for doing. Like I said, it was a lot of old school stuff.
Yeah.
So the art team probably used Photoshop and those software, the Adobe suite. I don't know what Ethan used to do like his outlines of the ships. Yeah. That may have been a layer, and that may just have been a layer in Photoshop as well. The portraits would have been done like by an artist and electronically sent to us. We didn't have like paintings lying around the office or anything like that. That's all that. Then it would go off to like I said, we would go through our production team and it would head off to the company that we had in Hong Kong / China. And they would, we would see stuff from them at that point. So whatever their factory did, but it was all standard stuff. I mean, it's the same stuff we probably use now, except it's a lot easier and more robust today. We didn't have 3D printing, so we didn't use any code writing like that. My spreadsheet probably had a basic engine underneath it, so that there was some stuff that was doing some simple other behind the scenes calculations. That was it. Very boring. Sorry, guys. We weren't using any cool state of the art anything.
No, that totally makes sense.
We're all using old school, old man stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally makes sense. I'll have to ask Ethan about like what modeling program he used or whatever. So,
We didn't have 3D modeling or anything like that. So that was a thing that we did not have.
Yeah, interesting. Do you recall any discussions with Tony Vigil, whose screen name online was Piranha, or Kyle Wolfel about the rules of the game? They were the rules arbitrators.
Yeah, I know Tony.
Yep.
Like personally.
Yep.
So external testing on the scale that
you mean like plate testing?
I'm going to apologize to all people who test externally because that's what I use almost extensively now. Mm-hmm. But back then, that was the leak. Hmm. So and what people don't really understand, and this is it, I can't tell people not to do anything, and I don't ever would tell people not to do anything. The bottom line is you got to think about how the down, and you may not care. That's the modern 2023 model. But back then, the biggest thing was, and it's still to this day, as they used to say in the old Battletech cartoon, power is ammunition. Learning the sets of what was going in the game and the secret sauce of a game before it was released was less important for you to share with everybody. You were more intent to say, hey, I'm testing. I get to test Pirates of the Spanish Main with Mike Mulvihill or, WizKids or whatever. And people would be like, oh, that's really cool. And then that was the end of the discussion. No one said, oh, now tell me all the stuff you're doing. Because one, you're usually under NDA. And two, you're a fan and you work with me. And you don't want to, in theory, piss me off because then you don't get to work on stuff anymore. Well, we had a real big breach with HeroClix. And that was worse because with HeroClix and when you're working with a licensor, technically a licensor controls all of that media relationship. Like with right now, I work with Disney. And Disney tells us when we start marketing things and when we start announcing things because they have a giant planogram of everything and they don't want your 2-bit small board game. I'm not saying that Villainous is a 2-bit small board game, but in conjunction to a movie, it's a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And they don't want that being somehow talked about when they're getting ready to announce a new park ride or a video and video game or some other big thing. So when a HeroClix set would get the names of the characters would get released, that was huge for us. We had no recourse back then. We didn't know what was happening. We just knew it was somebody external who had a list of stuff, who had a bone to pick, usually a bone to pick with us. That's the other weird thing that's not the case nowadays. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's like, all I can tell people is, if you say this, you're never working for me again, okay? And if you say this, I can't guarantee whether or not Disney's going to care. So it's really on your conscience of how much you want to anger me and anger possibly Disney. But back then it was a lot less of that. It was the early days of the internet, so people could get by with a lot more stuff. And so it was really hard for me to convince the company to go to external testers who were getting my spreadsheet and in doing stuff. Yeah. Like I said, I use them. Tony's one of the guys I use. I remember that for sure. And there was a whole, again, I had to say, don't say anything, don't do anything, that's not cool. And they were really good. So this was not a rant about them. It's just a rant about the fact that the company was always slower than I needed the company to be to get more info out. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I couldn't just put a post up on Discord and say, hey, I'm starting a private Pirates Discord channel for WizKids. who wants in and just catcall everybody and then get, you know, 100 people in there. That would never, well, one, there was no such thing as Discord. Yeah. So everybody was using, you know, going back and forth with me directly. But the company was like, who is this person? And we need to vet him and we need to do this. And it was like, oh my God, I don't have time. I need somebody to look at these. So I know, Tony, you did a lot of looking at spreadsheets. So Tony, if you're listening, thank you. And a couple of other guys that did a lot of stuff. The biggest questions I would get back would literally be about the ships and about play. Every once in a while, there might be, how does this fit in the bigger scheme of things? Like, is this rule good? And we would make rule changes. Again, this is the thing, like the Dutch at the very beginning, or anything, the forts at the very beginning. If you're playing the game and it's not right, then that's your, you know, as a play tester, you need to tell me, and then I will make sure that I hear that and we make a new decision. Sometimes I'll go back to that play tester and go, okay, you're encountering this. Is it, you know, a constant, like every time this ability happens, it's bad? Or is it like in a scenario situation where it happens when A and B and C are also happening? Yeah. And then, you know, what did you do to, the cool thing about playtesters, and especially modern playtesters, is they don't stop. The game doesn't end when they run into something that's not working right. Yep. They go, well, I'll do this instead, yep. You know, and that's what I want to hear. I want to know what you did to keep playing, you know, yeah. Because if you fixed it, I'm going to use that, you know. So I don't remember like a singular, like long, evolved discussion. My pushback always is when a player tells me something's wrong, I need to hear the scenario that it was wrong in. Then I need them to try it in other scenarios to see if it's really wrong or if something's broken in this one-off weird combo thing. Now, I still fix it, but I need to know the context, whether the whole rule needs to be tossed, whether we just need to change the wording, whether we need to figure out this one singular interaction. So I need that. Those are all tools I need. So I do know Tony. Thank you again, Tony, for all the work you did for me. The second guy, Woods, you said?
Kyle Wolfel.
Wolf. Yep. What's his full name?
Kyle Wolfel. It's like Wolf and then EL at the end. So
maybe. I mean, like I said, there were a handful that were my go-to guys. Tony, I know because I knew him later as well, but, yeah. I don't remember. I apologize.
No, that's fine. He said he only worked
all other playtesters. I apologize as I try to do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's totally fair because Wolf was always remote. He wasn't at the WizKids office at all. And also, he only took over as rules arbitrator, I want to say, in 2006. So it was kind of, there was less overlap with you and him than there would have been with Tony and you. So
yeah, and Tony. There were a couple guys external. Mm-hmm. Well, Tony would have played internal. If he would have been testing, he would have been testing internally, and he would have done, we would have used mock pieces. But there were some people out of the office that I sent full on spreadsheets to and asked them. Like I said, that's where I would get these ships are the same. I don't know if Wolfen was one of those guys. There were a handful of people back then. I'd have to look. I don't know.
Yeah, no worries. Awesome. So from Zarek Seed, he's my friend that you met, Bill, he's from LA.
Oh, yeah.
He had some questions. We already talked about the original point limit of 30 points was kind of because it was supposed to be kind of a smaller scale game and there were maybe cheaper ships in the first few sets and Jordan wanted his kids to be able to play. And then it sounds like it was changed to 40 for more variety and some of the additional sets that came out and whatnot. I don't know if there's any other more to the story that I'm missing, but I think we mostly covered that.
I think so. I don't remember there being like, oh my God, the game no longer works at this size. I don't think that ever happened.
Yeah. Nice.
You know, so that's definitely not a thing that occurred.
Yeah.
Nice. So it was much more organic. A lot of times people just need to go, especially with games, we're not, you know, we just need to like look at it from a what do you think the most logical explanation was? Yeah. we didn't have to reinvent anything, thank the maker.
So then he had some follow-ups as well. Were other suggested point limits for games discussed or tested among the designers, like 35 points or 50 or 60?
Okay, so yeah, there's a couple of things that are kind of funny about something. The one that we originally thought was 25, and we cut it because you're just stuff. I say stuff and people will go, I don't believe you. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but it's true. Doing 5-point builds was like people's brains exploded. You know, it's like that didn't, even though 25, you would think, well, that's a logical number. People should be able to get 25 points. Somehow in doing the builds, or either the fact that the numbers, remember, we're nothing in our game. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in our game that ends in a 5 or a 0, but a lot of stuff ends in 2 or 4, the yep. 3, you know, they have 7, you know, they have none. There any value between, you know, the range of values on the ships.
Yep.
And so when you told people to make something to 25, you would just watch them brain melt.
Yeah.
You know, so 35 and 25 were right out. They were like literally right out. And so then it was like, okay, you know, and like I said, when we did the first set, it was more about no more than 2 or 3 ships, you know, with a couple of crew and, you know, a 30-minute game. And that was 30 points was the logical number. You know, again, based on whatever that main, that 0-point character that I told you about, not 0.0 on the scale, the center of the scale, if yep. you will. He may have been, I think he was an 11-point ship. I'm going to look and see at the spreadsheet while we're talking.
Awesome.
But I don't know. I don't know if that's,
Yeah. Yeah. I can concur that I play games almost exclusively ending in like 0, like 40 or 50 or 60. I know I've done a few 45 point fleets, and I've played games at 75 and 85 points, but I would say probably 98 or 99% of the games I've ever played are, you know, in multiples of 10 basically. So, and yeah, I was looking at that earlier for that ship. I didn't see a 2-master with L speed. But if you say 11 points, that kind of changes it a bit.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking right now. I don't see one. That could be. It could have been the Revenge, may have been the 0-point ship.
Interesting.
No, that's 4 masts. That's too high. It would not have been a 4-mast ship because I have all the lower masts.
Yeah, you think 2 or 3 masts? Okay.
Yeah, I'm like looking at 10, 3 masts.
Yeah, HMS Bergenhead was, you said the first one may have been English, so. That one's an English HMS Bergen.
Yeah, it's just a thing. I just couldn't remember. But the bottom line is there was this ship, this mystical ship. We may not have made it. That's the other thing. They ended up creating it. We just may not have created it. We just said that's what we think the center is.
That's what I'm thinking,
But the bottom line is there was no real, like, the impetus was about play. You know, it was like, what makes a better thing? To answer the question about more, we kind of talked about it. The goal would have been for us to create the. All right. And just everybody understand this. This is not a negative about WizKids. I'm not upset. I'm not angry. But there's, at every game company, there's a pecking order of games. mm-hmm. And the pecking order of games at WizKids was HeroClix was the number one. Technically, BattleTech would be number two, mainly because that's Jordan's baby. Okay. That's the first game he ever created. It's the one he always involves himself in. Every element of it, ever since it's come out, he is involved in somehow. It's how he got the electronic rights and created a game company that I went to, an electronic game company that I went to because of it. But BattleTech's his baby, and it was always going to have a higher thing. Pirates was number three at the best, maybe at its highest point. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you got to understand that spending a lot of time developing long-term pirate strategy was never really the be-all, end-all of this game. In fact, it may have been the end of the strategy, may have been when we got Disney's license, because that's what Jordan wanted from the very beginning. He would have loved for the first set to be Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie stuff, but it didn't happen until the sixth set. So in his mind, once we hit that point, and again, once we created this world of piracy, that we did to get to that point, it didn't have the same long-term planning that we need to do. We did not have people lining up at Gen Con to play in tournaments 24 hours a day. We did not sell, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of products. It's just the real reality of the situation. What we created was this awesome entry-level game that people, even to this day, play, you know, out of a booster pack, you know. So we did something really cool, but it, and on the scale, it had a different market, it had a different place, and WizKids was never big enough to promote three games at maximum volume. And so to that end, long-term strategic planning, like how would we do a 100-point game? How would we do a 50-point game? How would we do that? Again, I think we talked about it earlier. It just never was on the radar. The radar was get the next set out, Mike, you know? And then now we're adding marketing in that second half of the game, you know, post Crimson Coast, I think, or Unlimited, we started to add marketing into it, and that was soft marketing. It wasn't huge. It wasn't HeroClix level marketing. And so, you know, it had a different cadence to that long-term planning. It was product planning. It was not long-term. We never sat down and said, what's our five-year plan? How do we grow this in the local gaming stores? How do we do cool tournaments and international tournaments? You know, can we even get something at Gen Con one year? You know, and it was more about demoing the game even through its existence than it was about supporting a long-term infrastructure. And that's a problem, you know, looking at it in 2023 going, shit, we should have done that. Look at it. It's still around. We didn't. And, you know, whether that's a personal failing or a group failing or just WizKids, again, prioritizing A over B, it's probably more of one than the other two, meant that we didn't really look at cool tournament structure, cool achievement structure, you know, come to Gen Con and win with every faction kind of structure, tournament games, you know, stuff like that, that now I look at it and to me, that's dropping the bucket. Why aren't we thinking about this at day one? You know, but we didn't look at it at all. So when you talk about like, did we think of like, hey, what could we've done with a 50-point game or a 100-point game? It just never came up. It was never on our radar. It was like, we now have a lot of packs out there. Let's get a 40-point game going. Because that should be the default, not 30. And then we did a board game. You know, it was like, that's it. That you've now, and then we did those various promo packs and stuff like that to give away and, or to sell. You know, that was it. Yeah. That was the maximum that we put into it. Unfortunately, talking to a guy who loves the game and didn't even pick it up until after it was done, you know, that's how it unfortunately played out. You know, there's regrets all over. Sometimes, and that's one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would argue it's not really a failing. I think there is value in keeping the standard build total the same throughout almost all the sets, because if you kept changing it around or increasing it, players might get a little confused as to what the default is, and they might look at rule books from different sets and be like, oh, is it 80 or is it 40? So I mean, I think it's fine, and I think it works pretty well for tournament style play and the organized play that they had back in the day at stores, because it allows for a shorter game and you can play a full tournament in a day, whereas if you do a 100-point game, you might only play two games in a 6-hour session.
Right.
So I think it's fine overall.
Yeah, it was. I think it's more about the fact that you think about it, and you know, this is game designer life. You think about things and you go, what if, you know, what if we put the big resources behind it? Could we have taken it to one more step up? Could we have done something else? It has nothing to do with whether the game is good or bad. I think the game is fine at 30 and at 40 points. Yep. I just think that it was like, what we want to do is give the players options to play. Yeah. And what I'm learning is we just didn't promote that or tell anybody about it. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. People play at any level. I mean, I usually suggest more than 40 and people are almost always down. I mean, 60 is a point limit that I hear is a favorite quite frequently, but I know a lot of players, the person who asked the question, Bill and myself included, we both love 100 plus points, 150. We did. You saw the beginning of that one. So yeah, there's really no limit to the amount of options and customizability you have. So I think it was fine the way it worked out overall. So do you remember the reason for the half the starting gold value rule being like the win condition?
Did that change at some point?
No, not that I recall.
I think the reason was
probably to make it quicker, maybe.
It was to make it quicker, and it was to make it so that we didn't have the end game that we had, if you will, when we played the last time, where it's like there's two pieces of treasure out there, and basically everybody's self-sacrificing or trying to be the last ship standing with that one treasure or two treasures. Again, speed. All right. So let's all remember what Mike was told he needed to provide, which was a playable game out of the package and a game that lasted less than 30 minutes. So in those tools, you know, it was, okay, play with X amount of gold, and the first guy who has that many gold win, you know, half that many gold, because the other guy can't win then, would win the game. And that was really what it came down to. So, you know, it's basically a 50 plus one rule, you know, that was done for speed. You can, you know, to me, it was an ignorable rule. I don't think I've ever played. It's the reason why I'm confused when you say that, is because I don't think I've ever played using that rule. And I'm the game designer. I always played, like, when we collect all the gold, guy with the most wins. And I think that was put in the game. The initial rule was put in the game because of who we thought our market was and what we wanted the game to be. When it's actually a real game, you realize, you know, you don't need to do that anymore. You know, you don't need to cut the end corner off, if you will. You could just play it all the way out to the bitter end.
Yeah. And that's what the multiplayer.
If we had ended at that, I would have won the game.
And I'm just yep. Yeah. And that's what the multiplayer rules have, where you play until half or more players can't give actions, or all gold has been unloaded to home islands, and the most.
Yeah. It just is much more fun, I think, because it makes more sense. It's the other one's kind of one of those, oh, look, I happen to find four golds, and that's 16. I now have 16, and we only ever put out 30, so I win. You know, you're like, wait, you've got three gold? I have like six sitting on my, you know, granted, in the big picture, if the game would have continued on, I mean, not if one, or maybe if there's special treasure in there, maybe I would have gotten something that boasted something, or I get 2 points whenever I unload a treasure, or two more gold. You know, there's a lot of ways that it was a way to arbitrarily end a game. Maybe you wanted to continue that, but that there was no real thought process beyond that.
Yeah, no worries. I think I'll send you a fleet from a while back, if I still have it, somebody else created, that I think you might find a little bit amusing. There was a unique treasure from Pirates of the Caribbean set where you can eliminate a crew and then they're worth one gold each. So somebody made a fleet where they packed their fleet with like ships that can explore on the first turn, and they're trying to like find this one UT, and then they have like 16 oarsmen just like sitting around on their ships or on their home island. And then as soon as they can unload that treasure, they sack all the oarsmen, and then they have 16. So yeah, it definitely got gamified to an extreme by some of the more some of the more advanced players over the years, but it's always fun to see those kind of exploits happen too.
I mean, the fun stuff, I love exploits. Okay. I'm a game designer. It's going to sound counterintuitive, but I love when people do that. But what I more love is when they refuse to do that because they're like, I like the game so much, you know, finding those holes. There's going to be holes like that in every game ever made under the sun, maybe except for chess, although a chess player may go, no, dude, there's this one, you know, but I'm not a hardcore chess player. But the fact of the matter is that there are just ways to do that kind of stuff that is super fun and super interesting. And but, you know, they're great to show off one time or even try it against a bunch of people. And then you go, okay, that was fine. I'm done now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's kind of how I think about some of it. It's like, I'll try something and be like, okay, if I keep doing this every game, these people aren't going to want to play with me ever again. So then it's like, all right, I'll try a different fleet now. So, yep. And so were any other victory conditions planned, but never put into practice?
No, and this is a thing that comes up a lot. I'm sure at some point you're going to ask me about the lawsuit, which I don't like to talk about because I don't really know anything about it. Always the main premise of the game was to be the one with the most treasure because it was a pirate themed game. It was not about owning the seas or controlling the seas or any of that. It was about ending the game with the most gold.
Yep.
And so therefore we never really examined like other victory conditions. We had talked about it with like some maybe like achievement based stuff that may not go towards victory, but may get you some other thing. We don't know what that would have been. Like you visit every island, you know, get to a certain point in the game with no damage, you know, that kind of stuff. That's just kind of arbitrary, but we pulled that off from the game because it becomes a record keeping thing. And the coolest thing about this game is the records all on the table.
Yep.
You know? And so we did not want to start doing stuff that said, oh, you get bonuses if you do this thing that you now have to track or you now have to keep in charge of. You know, the gold's there. I like the way it's really funny. I like the way you did the gold, where when you had the crew that gives you the plus two, or the ship that gives you, when you unload gold, you get plus two gold or your gold's worth plus two. I like the way you did it. It wasn't the way we had done in the past. We used one of the little D6s and just rotated it and just had every time. Yeah. But I like the way you did it as well. But we didn't, there was nothing really that had any kind of long term. I got to track this thing. I got to remember this. And so those started to drop off as maybe something we might put in a, like a tournament structure. Like I said, when we started talking about doing things at Gen Con or any of the bigger conventions, but they never really got very far because it just became a game that the game didn't have record keeping in it and it didn't need record keeping in it. And so other stuff started to kind of fall apart. I mean, I actually like playing heavy, like, unique treasures because I just think that that's such a wild card in the game. I love that, but that's me, you know, not everybody does, not everybody likes them. And I get that. And so like all of a sudden right there, you're just like, wait a second. If we added like a new type of victory condition, is everybody just going to default to the old one? Cause it's logical, makes sense. And is perfectly fun. You know, we also didn't want it to be a combat game. We didn't want it to be like, I control the seas to go out and destroy everybody because that eliminates an entire mechanic of the game. If you're going for that, you're never landing at an island. You're never collecting gold. You're just running around hunting people. And then that becomes a chase element of just like fire on ships. Your strategy is totally different. It's like either you park in front of an island waiting for somebody to come to you and never move, or you chase other ships around. And if you're not fast enough, you never catch them. It just, none of that made sense for the game we wanted and the game we intended. Again, going all the way back to the very first discussions with Jordan and Mike and James and saying, what is the game you guys made? And asking Jordan, what is the game you want to be made? And then trying to figure out how to make a product out of that nexus point. It just never came up. Nobody wanted that other game. So no other game really evolved. I mean, the board game is the closest maybe to doing something totally different. And that was mainly because Europe wanted a board game. So, you know, Europe didn't really have, when we were doing it, even people don't realize this, Magic was not hardcore into Europe. There were no real good collectible model games in Europe. They collected stickers because that was their trading cards, their sports trading cards, but they didn't collect game pieces. They didn't really understand it. They're like, if you want to sell this game, we need a board game. So, and here's a crazy story. The guy who is my counterpart in Germany, Ravensburger, his first game he ever developed, his first job, his first game was my pirate game, which was pretty cool. So wow. That's pretty exciting. But the bottom line is, that's just a total aside that I like to say because I think it's funny. It never really came up as a concern or an interest or something else. And people may have brought it up, but in like talking to me and casually, but it was nothing. I'll tell you, when it's all said and done, tip my hat to Mike and James. The core of this game is very elegant, very, very elegant. And we didn't want to mess that up, so we didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that answers the next question, too. It sounds like the design team always wanted the game to revolve around racing to get treasure rather than fighting to get treasure, even though combat obviously can be a side effect of, you know, competing for
It's that yin yang. Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
We wanted, the treasure was was important because, again, when you talk, like I said, when you're talking with Jordan, he's talking about guys who were swindlers, pirates, con men. And to him, the whole treasure chest of gold and the, blah, blah, the pirates were looking for gold. They were not looking to rule the seas. Pirates were not going out and hunting ships. The other ships were going out and hunting pirates because the pirates were stealing their stuff. So yeah. When you kind of look at it from the holistic historical standpoint, yeah, Spain and England wanted to rule the seas. And, that's the third Pirate of the Caribbean movie, if you want to kind of a non-fictionalized version of history or a fictionalized version of true history. But it was really the pirates were there going, hey, we got a ship. You guys got a bunch of stuff. We want that stuff. And we're going to go party in this town. I mean, that's all they really did. They didn't like invested in real estate or any crazy things like that. So they were like just stealing stuff. And the Spanish and English got tired of them stealing stuff. And then the Spanish said, well, wait a second. If they're stealing stuff, maybe we can act like we're stealing stuff and we'll steal it from the English. So the English would steal, so they started stealing from each other, and the French started stealing from each other. It was the Americans who did the less of the stealing and more of the stuff, stewed on everybody in our waters kind of mindset until they decided they needed to hire pirates. And then it was like, oh, okay, well, they have a purpose. So from our standpoint, it was like a fighting game is like not interesting. We had HeroClix, we had Mage Knight, we had Battletech, we had these games that were centered around fighting. Every game out there is centered around fighting. What if we made a game about not the fighting part, but the other cool part of piracy, which is the piracy part? So that was kind of the mindset at the very beginning. It was, and like I said, when I had to make the Nexus point, it's where we said, okay, this is the key center point. We want to go 1, 2, 3. One was playable out of a pack. Two was 30-minute game, super simple, keep it as easy as possible, which is why we came up with those like IKEA-like rules in the rule book. And then three was make sure the game is always about everybody still having a chance. You can't come out with a ship that's going to blow everybody's ship out of the water and win the game, because usually you're chasing somebody who's faster than you then. Yeah. It just seemed logical, and we just kept double down on it because it just made the most sense for gameplay and for story and for immersion. You got to remember, part of me, my history with games is that I believe games are stories, and that you're going to sit down and you're going to tell a fun story, and no one's fun story ends with, and then they slaughtered me in the water. That's kind of a boring, kind of trite story. So we wanted to go, hey, no, you get cool stuff. You're going to get gold, and the winner's going to have the most gold. And if you're a pirate, you're going, ha, ha, ha. If you're the English, you're like, I got you all. And if you're the Spanish, you're like, we're trickier than everybody else. So there you go. I mean, that to me, that just tells a better story. So we never really looked at it, and we never really said we don't want it to be a game that's not about collecting gold.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it worked really well, too, in the end. So, and of course, anybody that wants to make it about fighting could just do a death match and use house rules and stuff and do whatever they want.
Again, just so people know, I don't go to your house and complain about, and tell you, I'm not the Pirates of the Pocket Model Pirates police force. You come to me and say, this is what we did. I watched you play a 150-point game, which was cool because it was a table filled with giant ships and sea monsters. And I'm like, this is the glory. So, I'm all there to support you playing whatever way you want. I'm just saying that the game's goal was not to do that. So,
yeah, absolutely. And we still, I almost never play deathmatch. We did one on the Maelstrom mat the night after. But yeah, even in the big games, we still, almost every game I play is just most gold wins still, like pretty regular rules for the most part. So awesome.
All right. That concludes this part of the interview with the amazing Pirates game designer, Mike Mulvihill. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, whether that's a comment on YouTube, follow-up questions in the thread at Pirates with Ben, or commentary on Discord or Facebook. Make sure to like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. There are links in the description for this episode where you can find some of the links and resources I used, and there's also an affiliate link to buy Pirate CSG items on eBay. Consider using that link as a way to support all my efforts to keep the game alive and hopefully even revive it as well. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.